Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers. Coming up on The Wire today...
The United States declared that announced that there will be no visa processing except the migrant visas.
In a worrying development, relations between Turkey and the US took a dire today as both countries imposed visa restrictions in a tit-for-tat move that has its origins in the perceived US protection of the cleric Fethullah Gulen, who now lives in Pennsylvania, USA. President Erdogan insists that Gulen was behind the coup attempt on his government last year. Also today on The Wire...
On super young people, it's borderline negative because a lot of teens out there are pretty impressionable.
On the first part of The Wire's five-part series into mental health, we take a look at the way social media ramps up the cult of celebrity and what this means for mental health for young people. Stay tuned for this and more coming up on The Wire. Well, the New South Wales state government has announced it will propose special laws to overturn a court decision against the Springvale mine. The court found that the Springvale mine in Lithgow is operating illegally due to its planning proposal being invalid. Philip Stempion investigates.
As the energy wars enter their third week, a new target has arisen. In Lithgow, New South Wales, major power station Mount Piper, which generates about 11% of the state's electricity, is supplied by Springvale coal mine. The mine's future has been hanging in the balance since August when the Land and Environment Court ruled the original approval for the mine was invalid. The New South Wales state government has announced it has plans to weaken laws protecting Sydney's water catchment areas to allow the proposed underground mine's expansion at the Springvale coal mine. Opposition leader Luke Foley has announced his party will support this legislation if it is presented to Parliament.
Parliament meets tomorrow. We'll be jumping up and down in the Parliament to ensure that legislation goes through that guarantees the future of the Springvale mine. Nothing less is acceptable.
Shadow Minister for Energy Adam Cyril says he's waiting to see if the government has legislation ready to go or if today's announcement was just a plan to have a plan.
The Premier found time to go to the Bathurst races yesterday but did not have time to meet with the local council or concerned members of the local community in and around Lithgow. The state government has had a deaf ear to concerns of the local community for the last 10 weeks.
The Springvale mine has been discharging leftover mining water into the Cox River, which feeds Sydney's main water catchment basin near Warragamba Dam. The discharge water is 20% above the allowable limit of saline or salt. One solution to this problem is to build a water treatment facility which will purify the residue water, but it won't be constructed until 2019. Adam Cyril says the state can't wait until then.
The delivery of the water treatment plan should be accelerated and should be delivered as soon as possible, and any legislative approval of the mine extension should be conditional on Centennial Coal, the mine operator, and Energy Australia, which is the operator of the Mount Piper power station, guaranteeing the delivery of the water treatment plant. We've got to protect the state's electricity supply. We have to protect local jobs in Lithgow. But we also have to protect the drinking water we all depend upon.
Sue Higginson is the CEO of Environmental Defenders Office New South Wales, which has been representing 4Nature, an environmental group, in the court case against Centennial Coal, the owner of Springvale Mine. The Court of Appeal has sent the matter back to the Land and Environment Court for all parties to reach a resolution to allow the mine to continue operating.
All the parties agreed that it was the most appropriate court to look at all of the evidence of what the operations at Springvale mean in the context of the harm that it is doing to the environment through the pollution of water. So next week is the day, next week, all parties go back to the court and argue what should or shouldn't happen based on the fact that the current approval that Springvale is operating under was unlawfully granted.
Today, the Minister for Energy and Utilities, Don Harwin, announced plans to change laws in order to ensure households and businesses have affordable, secure and reliable energy supply. Mr. Harwin said in a statement that
Springvale Mine is the sole current source of fuel for Mount Piper Power Station, and we are keen to avoid any disruption to its functions. My top priority as Energy Minister is to ensure New South Wales households and businesses have an affordable, secure and reliable energy supply. This decision supports that.
Energy Australia says Mount Piper Power Station provides power to 1.5 million people around New South Wales and is expected to work until 2049. If these laws are proposed and passed, then they will circumvent the court system, making next week's court case in the Land and Environment Court redundant. Sue Higginson from the EDO says the so-called special legislation is premature and highly controversial.
Really, special legislation should be a matter of only when there is an absolute need case to undertake such a step, and even then, only as an absolute last resort. We have laws, and we are meant to apply those laws and live by and under those laws. Special legislation is about changing the rule book completely.
While debate rages on within the State Parliament and the Land and Environment Court, the mine continues to discharge saline water into the Sydney catchment.
At the moment, there is expert evidence that the continued discharge of highly saline water and containing heavy metals, millions of litres a day, into the Cox's River is having a negative effect on the quality of water that is going into the drinking water catchment. This is mine discharge being poured straight into the upper reaches of Sydney Water's drinking catchment.
Sue Higginson, CEO of Environmental Defenders Office New South Wales, ending that report by Philip Stempion. The US and Turkey have put in a mutual travel ban, cancelling all visas except for those who are migrating. The situation between the two countries has been tense after America refused to extradite Fethullah Gulen, who has been living in Pennsylvania in exile since 1999. Bertha Shingen reports.
The last situation as of today, as of this morning, is that the suspension of the visa processing by United States and by Turkey against each other. So United States declared that announced that there will be no visa processing except the migrant visas. Just afterwards, Turkey responded with the same measure. So they announced that Turkey will also blocking U.S. applications, the citizens of the U.S. to apply the Turkish visa. There's a very funny thing here, because the Turkey's Washington embassy announced this decision with the same text of the U.S. decision. Only change the names.
These tweets from the American and the Turkish embassy might even be seen as a comment on the situation as a whole, seeing as it says the exact same things.
So this is today. This is basically by the United States making Turkey some sort of equal with Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen.
It might even seem as America is putting Turkey in the same category with these countries, which would be insulting to the Turkish.
If you know, United States are imposing some sort of visa blockade to countries which are known as rogue states or the civil war states or the just not allies of the U.S. Turkey and the United States have been allies nearly 50, 60 years, and the relations were never such low. They were reliable allies to each other. So what is the essence of this? Let me summarize this also. This is related with the cleric which escaped from Turkey after 1996 military memorandum, and who has been residing in U.S. state of Pennsylvania from that time on.
Fethullah Gulen went into self-imposed exile in America in 1999 and was last year blamed by Erdogan to be behind the failed coup at the time. The Americans has refused to send him back as there is no reason to believe he is guilty. As an answer to this, the Turkish imprisoned the American pastor Andrew Brunson.
But after the coup attempt of July 2016, last year, Turkish government claimed that this person is behind this coup and wanted him to be extradited by the United States. And the United States claimed that there is no proof or clear proof show that this person is behind this coup attempt. Turkish government arrested an American pastor. And this is some sort of swapping agreement. So we have your pastor, you have our cleric, so let's swap these people. United States rejected this. In the last part of this conflict, United States Embassy has a person who has been working for the embassy as a local resident, who has been working for the American consulate in Istanbul. In the government media, suddenly there were news that from the office of the Turkish prosecutor, who was allegedly one of the top figures of this Gülenist movement, but they were in contact. So some person from the United States consulate and this person. Then after this news, Turkey arrested this person. So after detaining this, United States protested this, and this visa issue came.
So it's not the first time in recent years and recent times in general that Turkey has had issues with westernized countries. Is this just a start or the beginning of Turkey separating themselves more and more from the West?
Well, in one sense, you are right. It is not only U.S. because the same thing has been happening with Germany, too. A German-Turkish citizen was detained by the Turkish authorities. He has been in prison for long, and Turkey is trying to make the same style swap with some sort of so-called Gülenists with the Germany. So just starting with some sort of small Gülenist perch, if we are saying small because I'm thinking the size of the Turkish-German and Turkish-American relationship, then it is getting bigger and bigger.
Even though Turkey is not a part of the European Union, they are still a member of NATO and holds close and important ties with the West. However, if the situation with the US and Germany gets worse, it isn't impossible that Turkey will have to leave NATO.
Turkey is still a member of NATO and Turkey is still a candidate country for the European Union. So the main skeleton, the main framework is still there, except there is some sort of problems. We have to wait to see what will happen. The last one and a half year, yes, Turkey is getting away from the Western camp. There are signs of this.
Although Turkey's NATO membership doesn't seem endangered in the very near future, it is of concern that Turkey has been sourcing military hardware from Russia after Erdogan made peace with Vladimir Putin.
Bertha Shingen ending that report with Dr. Murat Yurtbeler from the Australian National University. Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network. Well, today marks a special occasion for the fight for Aboriginal land rights and native title in Tasmania. A property located in Tasmania's northwest coast is home to Aboriginal cultural sites and endangered species. This has been purchased by Tasmania's Aboriginal Land Council with the help from the Bob Brown Foundation and the Tasmanian Land Conservancy. A ceremonial event took place at the Tarkine property known as King's Run. Evangeline Maguire reports.
Today, the Aboriginal people of Tasmania received good news. A remote property in Tasmania's northwest coast is being returned to its traditional owners. The 338-hectare property located in the Tarkine is known as King's Run and was purchased for more than $1 million by Tasmania's Aboriginal Land Council and with donations from the Bob Brown Foundation, WWF founder Graham Wood and the Tasmanian Land Conservancy. A ceremonial event was held today at the property to mark the special occasion, with a mixture of generations from elders, local members and contributors attending. Jenny Weber, campaign manager of the Bob Brown Foundation, was at the event.
We're having a celebration at King's Run on the northwest coast of Tasmania today as this significant area of land is returned to Aboriginal ownership. Indigenous cultural sites and several endangered animal species will be protected with the purchase of King's Run Station by the Tasmanian Aboriginal community.
Tim Larkin, Divisional Manager of the Indigenous Land Corporation, was at the event today and represented his organisation's role in the purchase of the traditional land.
The OLC was established to acquire and divest land on behalf of Aboriginal organisations around Australia. So we were approached by the Aboriginal Land Council of Tasmania and the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre when they became aware that the property may be being put up for sale, and the vendors of the property were also very keen for the property to go into Indigenous hands. So the OLC was contacted by each of those organisations, and over a period of time we managed to partner with other organisations like the Tasmanian Land Conservancy, the Bob Brown Foundation and the Graham Wood Foundation to raise the funds required to acquire the property.
The Bob Brown Foundation also helped the Tasmania's Aboriginal Land Council purchase the cultural site. Jenny explains that the Bob Brown Foundation saw this purchase as intrinsic to Aboriginal native title and land rights.
Bob Brown secured $385,000 from donations to enable the Aboriginal Land Council of Tasmania to buy the property. Indigenous Land Corporation, which is the Australian government organisation, they granted $680,000 to the purchase of the land. And Bob Brown Foundation secured the remaining donations, which was really fantastic for us to be able to play a role in such an important partnership with the Tasmanian Aboriginal community to, you know, secure this land and rightfully return it to the traditional owners. The purchase will help the Aboriginal community re-establish its place in the broader West Coast cultural landscapes.
The property was bought for more than $1 million, with Tim believing the investment is money well spent.
You know, we absolutely think it's sound value for money. The cultural heritage, you know, the pre-colonisation archaeology on the property is absolutely significant. We've been looking today at middens and seal hides, and also the environmental significance of the property is absolutely unquestionable. There are a number of threatened and endangered species that reside on the property. So, you know, from our perspective, it was absolutely a sound investment on behalf of the Aboriginal community of Tasmania.
King's Run is known for its immense beauty and home to 10 Aboriginal cultural sites and many endangered species, including the Tasmanian devil, wedge-tailed eagle and orange-bellied parrot. Jenny describes the property.
It's actually just rolling, beautiful grasslands where wallabies and wombats and the devils and orange-bellied parrots make it their habitat. As equally and, you know, globally significant is the Aboriginal cultural heritage sites that are on the land. And there's hut depressions and seal hides, just incredible examples of 10 cultural sites where the Aboriginal people would have lived an extraordinary life on this big wild coast where the cleanest air in the world, you know, runs over the coastline. So it's a remarkable property, and we're very excited today to be joining in this celebration.
Covering such a huge range of land, the Tarkine property will be conserved by an Indigenous Protected Area program, Tim explains.
There's actually a second property that's owned by the Aboriginal Land Council of Tasmania called Premaniana, which is approximately 15 minutes away from King's Run. And there's an existing Indigenous Protected Area program that's operated on that property. So there are Indigenous rangers that are already conduct ongoing land management and conservation work on that property. And King's Run will be included in the broader management plan within that program.
A symbolic event that marks a symbolic fight for land rights. Tim describes the event as intrinsic to the importance of land in Aboriginal culture.
What it continues to demonstrate is the importance of land to the Aboriginal community. Now, the ILC was established specifically to address the dispossession that took place of Aboriginal people around this country. And, you know, the ILC has acquired 250 properties, in excess of 250 properties now around Australia, and has divested approximately 80% of those to Aboriginal organisations. And today was just another example of, you know, the importance that land plays in the culture of Aboriginal people in Australia. So it was, you know, it was great to see, and it was fantastic for the ILC to be a part of.
Tim Larkin, Divisional Manager of the Indigenous Land Corporation, ending that report by Evangeline McGuire.
Reception isn't always the best out here in the bush. But if I miss The Wire, I listen to the podcast.
The Wire, across Australia weeknights on Indigenous and Community Radio, and now podcast.
Yes, I'm Roderick Chambers and you're on The Wire, which is on Indigenous and Community Radio throughout Australia. Well, it's Mental Health Week this week. And on The Wire, we're bringing you a series looking at the mental health of young people, some of the pressures in their lives that can tip them over the edge. Society has always been fascinated by celebrities, But the internet and social media have brought that fascination to a whole new level. Every day, every hour, we're constantly barraged with a constant stream of images and stories about the lives of the famous, which are retweeted, liked, and breathlessly commented upon. With mental illness disorders on the rise, Nicole Wedding asked some university students about who they follow on social media.
I follow a few bands, but like I won't go to their page and be like, oh my God, is there anything new from them? It's like I'd like to see if they have an announcement or something like that.
I don't follow specific artists for their music. It's more the other content they produce for social media, but I mostly follow like brands, mostly clothes.
I follow a few bands. I don't go searching for their stuff, but when it comes up, I am pretty keen to hear where they are in the world and what they're doing.
The general sense was that most young people are curious about what celebrities are doing, but not obsessed. I asked those same students whether they thought celebrity culture was healthy.
I think the problem really comes when we start to idolise these people and forget that they're human.
On super young people, it's borderline negative because a lot of teens out there are pretty impressionable.
I say admire would might be a better word. Like, I wish I was more connected in the real world, I guess, to them.
There is a kind of a healthy amount of celebrities who do use it as an activist platform. So, for example, Ricky Gervais.
Leonardo DiCaprio. It purely depends on how you use it.
Exactly.
To find out more, I spoke to Dr. Peggy Kern, a senior lecturer at the Centre for Positive Psychology at the University of Melbourne.
As young people are exposed to different things, especially celebrities and whatnot, it gives a lot of images about what you should look like, what is valued, what is not valued, often in ways that can give a message of sort of this perfect being that if they can't actually obtain that, that can at times have a negative effect on how they're thinking and how they're feeling about themselves.
Before social media, celebrity culture still existed. Do you think that it's worsened the problem?
It seems like it's grown much more. Social media has, number one, increase the size and the speed of all of that. So it's not just sort of pick up a magazine once in a fortnight. Now it's every time you turn on the feed. And then along with that as well is social pressures. Through social media, you have all the likes and who shared things. And so there's a social judgment to it. Others like this, so therefore I should like this or I need to be like that.
Dr. Peggy Kern, senior lecturer at the University of Melbourne. Will Storr is a journalist and novelist. His latest book, Selfie, deals with the topic of fame and how it affects mental health.
The route to understanding how it works is the fact that we are tribal animals. So we did most of our relevant evolution hanging about in sort of big hunter-gatherer groups of around 150 people kind of roaming around. And we're still behaving in those tribal ways, and that leads to some really weird outcomes. And they feel normal because they are normal in the literal sense. And celebrity culture is kind of one of them. We've adapted to unconsciously identify the people who are doing well in the world, and we unconsciously sort of mimic them and copy them. Now what happens is that if we see somebody kind of displaying, say, wealth, that triggers these mechanisms. We'll begin attending to that person. Sometimes what happens is that we begin attending to a person, the media will notice that, oh, there's this person over here that everyone's looking at. So the media will report on that. And then we'll begin attending to them more. So the media will report on them more. And then you get this feedback loop. And then you end up with this kind of very unusual, slightly mediocre person suddenly becoming famous. Nobody can work out how it's happened. They call that the Paris Hilton effect.
Jackie McIver is the Senior Program Manager at Reach Out Australia. She says it's important to keep an open mind when it comes to celebrities and realise that good comes with the bad.
On the one hand, through social media, celebrities can portray unrealistic expectations when it comes to images of beauty and body image, and this can put extra pressure on young people who feel, in that example, that they need to look a certain way. And so we often think it's important to recognise that many celebrities are curating their image online, you know, showing themselves at their best. There are teams of people going into achieving that final effect. But on the other hand, through social media, we also get to connect more directly with celebrities as people. And this allows us to often see them, you know, in more natural settings. So when we look at those celebrities who use the platforms to share their experience of volunteering and giving back to the community, and that can provide a sense of inspiration and connection.
For those facing mental health issues or dealing with other adverse impacts because of the ubiquity of celebrities, author Will Storr says there may be hope yet for sweeping change.
I think it will reach a point where it's going to stop. When I wrote the book, one thing I mentioned was shop dummies in women's high street clothing stores. I don't know if they were size zero. So again, which is unconsciously really delivering this message that in order to kind of flatter our clothes, you've got to be so thin that you're essentially sick, dangerous for your health. There is now at least talk of legislation of outlawing this. It's becoming much more taboo now to show these kind of skeletal models in fashion magazines that haven't paraded about as this is normal. It is anything but normal.
Will Storr, author and journalist, ending that report by Radio Adelaide's Nicole Wedding. Well, that's it for The Wire today. The Wire is a team effort by 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. You can hear us on your radio or online in Australia weekdays. We're back again tomorrow, so tune in again then. Today's program came from 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. I'm Roderick Chambers. Thanks for your company.
Let's enjoy new stuff, old stuff, a real variety.
My pleasure.
And yay!
2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
Breath now.